Hello.
John Malkin later, about 8:30. Still getting feedback?
Well, there, but just... I'll just put that there.
All right. We talk about... You're a communist, correct?
Trotskyist, yeah.
Trotskyist. You don't like the Stalin version. John's a anarchist, so we're going to compare the two. They both kind of arose around the same time. You follow history, is that correct?
Yeah, they did. The Marx and Bukharin and so forth. I mean, 1800s. There were debates back then. Interesting things if you read Engels and Marx at that time. Some of the same arguments you see in the 1800s, and in terms of the fights for power in Spain, as you did again in the 1930s, again in Spain, mm-hmm. With the anarchists becoming part of the government, becoming part of the bourgeois government.
Yeah.
Not legitimate Marxists, though. The Stalinists did in the 1930s, but the Trotskyists never became part of that bourgeois government, either in the 1800s with the Marxists or the 1930s with the Trotskyists.
They're part of the military, though, right? Now, that Spanish Civil War is so confusing with all those different factions going.
Trotsky opposed supporting the bourgeois government. And instead advocated the workers taking power, and instead the anarchists and the Stalinists became part of the bourgeois government and helped that bourgeois government disarm the workers, and then through that put Franco in a position of where he was able to take power.
Yeah. Also, I read somewhere that the French were kind of holding back weapons from the Soviets. Really could have helped as well. It's a complicated situation.
Well, yeah, but the biggest thing was that the workers were in a position where they could have taken power,
mm-hmm.
and the government needed the Stalinists, needed the anarchists,
needed those workers
in order to disarm the workers and crush them, and that's what they did. And, you know, 6 months after the anarchists joined that government, their headquarters were being bombed by the government itself. And soon after that, the fascists were coming in and taking over the whole thing. But the disarming of the workers by the Stalinists, by the anarchists, by the bourgeois government, that's what defeated the whole revolution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of arms, I mean, there were arms. I mean, the Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, they were participating in arming Franco. There were other things involved, but a major thing was the workers were disarmed, and mm-hmm. a movement that's about to take power, that could have taken power, being disarmed can be a very dangerous thing, because that's when the right-wing reaction, the pro-capitalist people who want to defend capitalism by any means necessary, mm-hmm. come back fighting, and they did.
Was it Mao said power grows out of the barrel of a gun?
Well, yeah, but not just out of the barrel of a gun, though. That's a lot of how Mao did it. But out of the power of the working class and the ability of the working class to shut down society and take over. The Russian Revolution was not carried out in the same way as the Chinese. The Russian Revolution happened with workers rising up in places like Petrograd, and then the soldiers being sent in by the provisional government, and before that by the Tsar, to put it down, and then the soldiers joining the side of the workers rather than opening mm-hmm. fire on them. It wasn't a question of building like a military force so much as building a political force of the working class to take power.
Mm-hmm. Also, there was, I think the railroad unions made it difficult for the Tsar's troops to move around. That really helped.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, the working class in general was in revolt and organized. And, you know, by the October Revolution, the Bolsheviks, who had been a year earlier, were a fairly small party, had grown to a very large one, and were able to organize and lead all over in different sectors of the working class, and also amongst the soldiers, where they had a lot of people on the front lines who were agitating against the war and for taking the government down instead of fighting against the Germans.
Do you have a weapon yourself, a gun yourself?
Well, that's legally, no.
Are you stockpiling ammunition out in the woods?
No. No.
I recommend that, by the way. I don't recommend, well, you know, open violent revolution, but I recommend preparing for a fascist coup.
I'm all for people doing that, and I'm all for people having guns. When I ran for city council, I even got the endorsement of the California Pistol and Gun Association for the answers I gave them on the questionnaire they sent me.
Little did they know they were endorsing a communist.
Yeah, but in terms of what happened at the anti-war protest here in 1999, where a woman and a child were being brutalized by the Santa Cruz police, and I stepped in and punched a cop in the nose. That put a felony on my record. So So legally, I don't own any guns.
Oh, that's right. You can own a gun. I didn't think of that. So you did some time on that?
Yeah, it was a 9-month sentence.
But then you collected a judgment for some. Was that for that incident or something else?
That was for a couple other things. It included there was a settlement with the sheriff's department for when the sheriffs beat me up in jail. They had been warning me to stop writing, and I continued to write. You know, this was over the course of a few days. There was a couple different warnings that came in, and then one day I was signing for my commissary, and another sheriff says, "Oh, Mr. RU, you're left-handed. I'll have to make a note of that. That'll come in handy." And so when they came into my cell, I'd been in solitary confinement at that point for about 4 or 5 months. When they came into the cell, they ordered me to kneel down with my hands behind my back, which I had to do, and then they handcuffed me, and they beat me up after they handcuffed me.
Real brave guys, huh?
And then they twisted my wrist around in the handcuffs to the point where I couldn't write for a while after that.
That's why they picked your left hand.
Right. Oh. And but there were eyewitnesses to that.
Oops.
And so there was a lawsuit that I won on that. It was interesting when I went around to the different cells asking people if they had seen it. One guy said really loud, "No, I didn't see a thing." And then he reenacted it. Like, he knelt down on his mat and he grabbed his own hair and slammed his own head against the wall. And then he came back and he slipped some information under. And he's like, but saying the opposite, right, you know, because right. He was afraid of any retaliation.
Sure.
Yeah. So
they could kill you in jail. No one would know.
Right.
Are those sheriffs still with the department? Were they disciplined? Or?
Let's see.
Did we see them at peace camp?
I don't know, but let's see. I forgot the name of the guy. Was one of the guys that did it. From what I heard, he got a promotion.
So. Well, that's, you know, you're a communist, and unions were a big part of communism, and, you know, the police and the sheriff's union is very powerful. You can almost never get rid of those kind of people.
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with the unions. So,
I knew you were going to say that.
And my position has been cops out of the union.
Cops out of the union.
Cops out of the union.
I think so too. I mean, what is
They're not workers, and they're there to
oppress.
Their job is to oppress.
Yeah.
And there have been Trotskyists that have held that position all over the world. There was a thing in Brazil where they were about to carry I'm not sure if they carried it out or not. Come to think of it. But there was a big campaign within this union to drive the cops out of the union. And the cops actually showed up at this union meeting with machine guns to intimidate people. But people kept going ahead. And I think they actually did get them out. I'm not sure. But, so it's been a real thing, you know, trying to get the cops out of the union. And I think it's a good thing to do.
And what about management being the, like the police chief here retired with 90% of his pension, $180,000 a year. What's up with that?
Yeah, I mean they take care of their servants and oppression. You know because
that's the kind of thing that makes unions look bad. People look at that and go, you know what the fuck? You know, no wonder he quit. You know, 51 or something. Mm. Quits after 30 years, and, you know, why bother working if you can get 90% of your salary for doing nothing? I guess they were doing nothing anyway, so.
Well, I'm not so sure that a chief of police would be in the union if the officers' union is organized like other unions. You know, management aren't typically part of the union. But the cops do get treated pretty well. And when the more violent and brutal ones tend to get promoted, and it's hard to get rid of them. This cop that was brutalizing that woman and child at the May 22nd, 1999 demonstration. What's that?
I heard that the child, she had a miscarriage or...
No. She wasn't pregnant. It was like it was a four-year-old child in her arms. It was screaming, mommy, 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 as the mother was screaming in pain.
Didn't you use a necessity defense?
Yeah. That
didn't go over with Attica.
Right. It didn't go over with the judge, and my lawyer didn't do a good job of it.
Had one of those public defenders?
Huh? No, he was... a lawyer that's in with the city government. I didn't realize it, and offered to do it pro bono, but I think to sabotage me. Ben Rice is his name.
I know Ben.
Yeah, he really screwed it up. Screwed up my defense pretty badly.
He's a nice guy. I don't know if I'd say he was in with the city government.
So well, you should have seen what he did to my case then. Huh. And anyway, the point I was making on that was this police officer was removed from the Santa Cruz Police Department for endangering the child. But then he
but
got
you still
then
got a felony but then, on it. Huh?
Right. But then he got a job right away with the Sunnyvale Police, so it's like
they're looking for a few good child beaters.
It's like even if they are removed from one police force, they can move to another, and usually they don't even get disciplined on their own police force. And here they are committing real crimes too.
Yeah, they are they're a form of organized crime. I believe.
Where you and I would go to jail
State
or prison for it, and not only do they get away with it, they often get promoted and they get
to
keep their jobs.
They commit perjury on a regular basis, is my impression.
Right.
That's a felony.
Yeah.
You know, I heard that, like you said, the soldiers will often come over to the revolution, but the police never will.
I don't know if never is quite right, but almost never. Yeah. There have been rare occasions. I heard in Wisconsin even the cops came over to the side of unionists camping out there. Well, just recently.
They're in a union too, so... Yeah.
So, you know, occasionally it happens. I mean, but it's much more likely for a soldier, because a soldier, it's not their career. It's something...
They're forced drafted.
Often forced, not forced here now in the U.S., right. But, you know, often but it's not something they often don't see it as what they're doing for the rest of their life, right. As a career. It's, you know, they've been doing it not as long. And then often drafts and things like that come in too. So a lot more often soldiers come over to the side of the revolution or of the strike, mm-hmm. You know, or things like that, than cops do.
Yeah.
But it has happened where the cops have. I wouldn't I wouldn't look for that though, so much.
Speaking of revolutions, you don't see Libya as a revolution. It's more of a reactionary.
I see two reactionary sides fighting each other there, the forces of Gaddafi and the government that the United States and the CIA and the UN are backing. Mm-hmm. But the rebels there are basically playing a role in helping the imperialists move into Libya. So I see them as the cat's paw of imperialism at this point, mm-hmm. and the cat's paw of imperialist aggression. So in terms of what they're doing, I give them absolutely no support. I oppose them. I think their defeat would be a better thing for Libya in terms of fighting off imperialism as part of this revolution that's going on in the whole region against the dictates of U.S. imperialism. Mm-hmm. All these dictators that have been imposed by imperialism.
All right, that sounds like John. I was going to say I'm a little more cynical. I think that this is the timing of it bumps the radiation coming over here off the news, and Obama gets a lot of financial support from. Nuclear power. Well, if that's John, try again. I picked up the wrong line.
Well, I don't think that's what's going on. I mean, I think there is something to the fact that the CIA played a role in starting, initiating the first protests in Libya. It's ringing again, it looks like. Or it just did.
Hello? Hello? Hey, John. You're on... Which number? John? John? John?
Hey, I can hear you kind of barely.
Can you hear me now?
Still like way in the background.
How about now?
Kind of the same.
I can hear you. You can't hear us?
Barely.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, I can hear, was that Steve?
Yeah.
I hear Steve really clear.
Oh, you can't hear me? Well, that's
good. It sounds like you're in another room.
Can you hear me now?
No, you sound really, really far away.
You might want to switch over to a different microphone.
How about now?
No, you're still really...
Is that one turned on?
They're all turned on.
Okay.
I can't tell them apart. I just turn them all on.
I hear you a little better. Maybe if you talk directly in the microphone,
that
I don't know.
Can you hear me now?
A little bit. Somehow I hear Steve, like, really clearly, and I hear you, like, you're next door.
Strange. Strange. How about now?
No, it's the same.
Well, I don't know what to say. I'm not good at this board. I'll have to speak loud. So, how's it going, John?
Really good. I had a wonderful day hanging out with my son, and then the storm came in, and, you know, yeah, just relaxing.
It's storming right now, huh?
Yeah, a little bit.
I'm walking. So, are you doing anything politically these days?
How am I feeling politically?
Or what are you up to politically? Causing trouble?
My political... stuff. What I guess I often talk about my radio show as being political. That's kind of where my activism found a new voice, you know, some years ago. So I'm doing interviews every week with spiritual teachers, activists, writers, and that keeps me in touch kind of with different things that are going on and different new ideas and hearing from people who are finding successes doing political actions or organizing or finding ways of dealing with suffering. I'm doing this ongoing class, Anarchy and Compassion, mm-hmm. that you have come to before, which has been wonderful. I'm going to do another one on April 3rd. It's a Sunday, and it's through Free School. It's 2:30 in the afternoon at San Lorenzo Park.
Oh, not Sub Rosa, huh? Like to mix it up?
What's that?
Not at Sub Rosa, like your last one.
You know, I keep doing it at different locations with sort of a different feeling for each one, too. I'm just experimenting with that. My idea is that hopefully it's going to be a nice sunny day on Sunday, April 3rd. I don't know. But I thought of doing it in the park, and I have some specific games that we would play to experience anarchy directly. So don't be afraid. It's all safe.
I'm not afraid. I guess, I know a little bit more about anarchy now. Basically, it's all about the meeting, right? That's the technique that's used?
Say that it's all about the what?
The meeting. Committee, mm-hmm. meeting, circle.
I don't know. I don't think of it exactly that way. Tell me more what you mean by the meeting.
Well, I mean, as I studied it, I studied what you had a sheet, the first class. Every one of your classes is different, I should say. If people go on to the other ones, you'll be doing something different at this one. And it had a lot of philosophy and stuff, but then it came down to, how do they actually do anything? How do they, you know, how did they run things in Barcelona and, you know, at the Sub Rosa? It's pretty much meetings, right? Everybody sits in a circle and has an equal say, like much like free radio.
Yeah, I mean, when it's a group involved, yeah, I suppose it does come down to meeting, getting together and talking and listening. And those meetings look really different. You know, I'm sure that's an obvious thing. Like, you have a meeting and it can be really difficult and confusing, or you can have a meeting, a get-together, where there's real open sharing and vulnerability and a freedom that's experienced by the people that are there. And that just depends on the intention set and the kind of experience that people have had and what kind of gathering it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, once I realized it was mostly a meeting, that made me think, well, you know, meetings aren't the best way to make decisions. I mean, they make okay for some things, but generally it's to groupthink and everybody conforms on a topic, and you don't get the creativity that you do from, like, a vote that is independent of other people.
You're talking about one problem, a major problem that can arise when people get together. That's conformity, mm-hmm. and people letting go of their real needs and being in touch with what they really would like, and they start conforming and rebelling. Equally is a problem when people just say, I don't want to do that, as someone else suggested it, or because it stimulates feelings in them, you know, fear or frustration or whatever.
Well, yeah, those sometimes are sometimes people just have different ideas.
Yeah,
and different ideas is, I think, natural. You know, in debate, and you know, I've had a problem in some of these anarchist meetings of the whole idea of consensus, as opposed to just taking something to a vote at a certain point, and you know, because actually, everybody doesn't have an equal voice if one person can stand up a democratic decision.
Stop everything.
Yeah, it can really take a long time. What's interesting is if you leave it to the people that are present to design the discussion that they're having, it sometimes gets complex and complicated. I think we've grown up thinking that democracy or democratic participation can be really smooth and simple, but we've actually been living in an authoritarian structure that's been called democracy, where really there's a few people designing how things are going to go, and occasionally people say what they would like or not like about that. Mm-hmm. And it's a little more difficult to have a real discussion with people. And it's funny, I just want to relay an experience I had these past days. I helped to teach a 5-day workshop on nonviolent communication. And a few times, you know, we're about to do like a process thing, and someone says something like, I think it's too warm in here. I'd like a window to be opened. That began like a 30 or 45 minute conversation among 25 people on, I want the window closed. I prefer a door open. Why don't you put on a sweater? Though it's a trip, and I think what I came away with mostly was just the reality that conversations like that can go on for 3 hours or 3 minutes, and it's really up to the people there to figure it out and do it. And frankly, we're not.
But sometimes you can take a conversation like that and say, okay, well, we don't need to keep beating on this conversation. Let's just take it to a vote and move on.
Well, that's what happens. Someone in the group says, you know what, I'm bored with what we're doing, and it's not what I came here to do. How about if we move on? And people say, yes, let's do that. Let's move on.
Mm-hmm. But part of my thing is with the whole idea of people voting rather than coming to a consensus, too, it's, you know, that minority person never has to... They don't get to hold the whole thing up, but at the same time, they don't have to give up on their position either at a certain point just to let things move on. They can just say, well, this is my vote, and I'm putting it out there that this is where I stand on this, and, you know, and then the group can move on to the next thing, or, you know.
Yeah. Well, and consensus, that isn't the original format of anarchism. In the 30s, they were just using straight-up votes in the meeting, I believe.
Mm.
In the U.S.? Or
in Spain.
In Spain?
Well, that's what I heard. I mean, I just read it on the internet.
I don't really know. I don't know. I've just, on that, I was just looking at what I've seen.
It's common now. Yeah. And that leads me to the next issue, is that because it requires that consensus and one person can fuck it up, there's a tendency in anarchist circles not to let new people in very easily. They want them to be kind of conform, very similar culture, same age, that kind of thing, in order to get consensus more easily. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that, you know, anarchism does have a rap that they're very standoffish. In fact, even a recent new DG here was saying, I said, how long have you been an anarchist? He goes, well, 6 years. I go, you know, many people are, well, just in the past 2 years have I met people in Santa Cruz, because they're all standoffish, the anarchist. Mm-hmm. And I go, you know...
Mm-hmm.
What's your comment on that, John?
I think there's some tendency among human beings to want to be free. And when people have a path or a philosophy or a group that they find freedom within, you know, some tools and some ideas,
mm-hmm.
Then they label that path or that philosophy, and then they put boundaries around it, and then they start to think that it requires particular ways of looking, dressing, sounding,
uh-huh.
acting, and then suddenly a freedom movement is has restrictive authoritarian qualities that people were trying to liberate themselves from, and that process happens over and over. That's why there's liberation movements to liberate liberation movements. Over just it's kind of a life cycle,
uh-huh.
and it happens that, you know, we would guess that, oh, the most radical liberation movements would be immune from that, and that, I guess that's kind of what I thought, and it's not so. They're also susceptible to this human tendency.
I find it even getting on coming to the meetings here originally. You know, there's. Do you believe in hierarchy? Are you against it? Because that's one of the tenets.
I would say generally I don't think it's that helpful. If it's authoritarian, I think sometimes it can be helpful if it's a kind of a partnership where people are agreeing to it without coercion. Like, what can I say? Something like, if you're doing a production and a theater production, and there's a stage manager, and 12 people are doing different performances, and you all talk to the stage manager because you want to have the lighting right for your performance.
Right.
That kind of works out well.
So you do. You're not a hardliner on no hierarchy, then.
I'm starting to enjoy distinctions between things like authority and expertise. So I don't
competence.
I don't think authority is that helpful, but expertise and people offering knowledge and help is really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go without that. So hierarchy, not so good, but what would be the word? I don't know if you guys have a word for helpful structuring of groups, but that's that. I think you can't. There are helpful structurings of groups.
Yeah, I do. I think a hierarchy has its problems, but for certain, I'm a panarchist more than anything else. For certain things, it's like for war. You basically, it's much better to have a hierarchy so you can act in a single purpose, and that's kind of where anarchists haven't done too well in warfare compared to communists or fascists or.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a vanguard party is that you need people with expertise that that have studied revolution and have an awareness of how to deal with the situation on a day-to-day basis and how you're going to make that move towards the seizure of power.
But of course, John will not seize power. Is that correct, John?
Well, I've gotten new ideas about power and seizing power, and that topic is really, really central for me now. I'm really interested in it. I'd be curious what you have to say more about that, Steve. Seizing power, I guess I came across this image from Joanna Macy, a Buddhist teacher, that this idea of revolution as being a group of people who are going to take power from another group of people and finally use it in a positive way and then give it back to everyone so it's not consolidated in a hierarchical group. That is, in Buddhism, it's called turning over the dung heap. And it's just, nothing has changed.
Not likely to happen, actually.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, nothing has changed.
Once you get a taste of power, it's like heroin, you know, you just can't give it up.
Tell me one revolution where nothing changed.
United States of America.
In the short term, nothing changed. But I think the American Revolution actually set the stage for the Civil War, and which I think was finished the revolution.
It's not over yet.
Of the bourgeois revolution. And
finished the class war.
It finished the bourgeois revolution, and it was a big step forward. At that point, anyway.
Well, John talked earlier about how our government really isn't truly democratic.
And actually, I'd say that the American Revolution in its beginnings actually, it was a bourgeois revolution, and it's hard to defend, especially in terms of how far we've come. We've brought more democratic rights since, and brought an end to certain discriminations, not an end to them, but transformed us in some ways. When it was a revolution at first where only white rich men were able to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a little bit tougher one, but I do think it did bring some progress.
Mm-hmm.
Well, also, it wasn't designed for one person to hold power. I mean, they had a president, and you could get rid of him with elections and stuff. So it was designed so you could get him out of power.
But it was a bourgeois revolution. It was a revolution where the bourgeois class
That's right.
Had power.
And they designed our government to not be leveling. The levelers happened like 1650s or so in the English Civil War, and they'd seen it, and they specifically did not want the lower classes to have power. We, like I said, it's unfinished. The lower classes have not yet had power in America.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
Are you a class warrior, John?
I don't think of myself in those terms exactly. I think more about a word or an image for me that's really important is nonviolence or non-coercion. And so related to classism is a form of violence. So that is something I'm interested in. Poverty, I mean, Gandhi really identified that poverty and systems of economic poverty is a system of economic violence, and maybe mm-hmm. the most harmful one, you know, that affects so many people, and it's so inbred into different cultures. So nonviolence is really important to me, and I'm really wondering these days about it and trying to get a better grip on power. And I have this idea that power, just this idea that we're going to have to take power from someone else is creating violence against that person, and that there's another way to deal with classism and issues of race and gender and control. It, actually, what I'm really interested in is control, and we all seem to be raised to believe that we would have better lives if we could just get the people around us to do what we want them to do. And that's already problematic within a family,
mm-hmm.
But when you have people that have tanks and guns and nuclear weapons, it becomes even more problematic.
Mm-hmm.
People start using those things to control other people. So I'm wondering about actually the relationship of anarchy to giving up control of other people, and similarly, taking control of yourself.
Well, again, it's not just two people. It's not just, you know, us and them. You know, if you don't take control, somebody else will.
Well, they'll keep power, the people who've been screwing everything up. You look at, like, one of the big historical questions in recent times in terms of the question of violence and power was played out in Chile with Allende. Allende being elected, carrying out a number of socialist programs that mm-hmm. helped the working class, very popular amongst the working class in Chile. And he never did the things that were necessary in terms of eliminating the power of the bourgeoisie that still controlled the apparatus of the government. The military was still firmly in the hands of the bourgeoisie, and that military, in a CIA-organized coup, was able to take the power back mm-hmm. and massacre people who believed in that revolution and completely destroy the moves that they were making forward. And you know, the question, one of the big questions we're up against is the fact that we're living under the most violent system that's ever existed on the face of the earth. And not only their system is threatened, whenever their super profits are threatened, they will use extreme violence against us. And the question is, how do you deal with that? In my opinion, you deal with moving them from power to weigh their violence.
Yeah, I would like that possibility of that sort of violence, the violence that we see now, eliminated, too. I mean, the people that travel all over the world, maybe you're one of them that's been to places where there's been a lot of violence done by the United States. You go to places like Chile or practically every place on the planet now, you know, if you say, what can I do to help? People say, go back to the United States and get your government to stop dropping bombs on us.
Yeah.
So you're right. I mean, eliminating this force in Chile would have diminished the possibility of Allende, you know, being overthrown eventually. But that would have taken, you know, you follow the roots back, and it's back to the United States, which there's a variety of strategies that people use for withdrawing their support from this U.S. violent power, or overthrowing it, or throwing monkey wrenches into it, or what I think is really hugely important, creating new systems of powerful organizing that, in my view, will replace the old systems and make them irrelevant.
That's in Gene Sharp's book. An alternative government is one of the most powerful techniques you can use.
Yeah, yeah, and there's been a lot of successes around the world.
All right, well, let's look at this locally now. What could we do locally? I think you're probably, too, one of the philosophers in town, a communist and anarchist. You're a thinking man's anarchist. You didn't fall for my hierarchy trap. you're flexible in your viewpoint. What could we do locally?
There's a free school class that Wes Modes has instigated, and it's something that I have been so interested in. It's getting together to talk about creating community response teams. So the long-term vision is the police in Santa Cruz won't be contacted. No one will need them. The way we get there is we create house to house in our neighborhoods, block to block, groups of people that have skills and tools to respond when there's difficult situations, from minor violence to major violence. The people that you could call, you would actually know them. They live down the street, they're familiar with you, and they have tools that could help. And like I said, long term, then you wouldn't even be asking for help from the police, and they would have to find something else to do with their time. Hopefully something productive.
Well, like, just come after us.
They'll just retire on 90% of their income. You know.
Well, a big part of the problem with the police is that they're not really there to deal with law-breaking amongst us, in my opinion. They're actually there to oppress us. And so, I mean, it's all well and good to have us working out our problems amongst ourselves, and I agree with doing that. But I think that the police are a bigger problem because they're the enforcers of this class rule and the system more than they're anything
John
else.
John completely agrees. You were on a panel or something that was a watchdog agency or something for the police, John?
Yeah, and this idea came out of that because the Police Review Board was created in 1995, and I was on the board for 2 years, and then I resigned. Then the board was disbanded 10 years ago.
Wasn't that from a vote or something of the people to create that?
No, unfortunately, actually, you know, that's one way we could have gone in creating it, putting it on the ballot, but what we decided was to lobby city council people and get them to create it. The problem with that was that they created a shitty police review board from the start.
With no power, I'm sure.
No, I wouldn't say no power, and they would argue that it had plenty of power. It had some power. I mean, I could go in with a group of seven police review board members and read police reports and police complaints. You couldn't do that before. However, in their terminology, we couldn't offer discipline. We could only make recommendations, and the board was not fully independent for a long time. Actually, the police chief came to our public meetings at city council chambers, and even the police review board members were confused. Michael Hernandez, who eventually, after that, became a city council person, I remember him saying, you know, I brought up the point, like, people are coming to these meetings because they're not wanting to go to the police. Why is the police chief sitting up here with us? And Michael said, he's on the police review board too. He wasn't. That's just crazy.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing was crazy. I saw a lot of the operations of it, and basically it was rubber stamping police misconduct almost always.
Yeah.
And we're doing
something about it. No, we really aren't.
And part of that is they were all the people on the police review board were appointed by the same city government that is already the boss of the police anyway. You know, each appointee was from a particular city council member.
Not quite true, Steve. It's the city manager that's the boss of everything. The city can do anything but...
I agree. A lot of people argue that. But no, the city council has the ability to fire the city manager.
That's true. I think they should. And the city attorney.
So really, it's the city council that's the boss of the city manager, the chief of police, and, you know, the city government.
But they have no fine-grained control.
They have no what?
Fine-grained control. They can't say to somebody lower, do this, do that. I mean, all they can do is fire the city manager. And he probably has a contract, so they have to wait a year or two.
They have the ability to move and on these things, but they choose not to because they agree with the policies being made and actually get trained in by these people when they get elected, from what I've seen.
Well, again, we're looking towards representative government, whereas, John, how would you favor a ballot initiative? I mean, ballot initiatives are kind of a form of anarchy, aren't they?
Yeah, I would say somewhat. And I think that likely, overwhelmingly, people would have voted for the police review board at that time. It cost a lot. And I think there had been a ballot initiative that did not pass for a countywide board like 10 years before that, so people were concerned about that. And in the end, I was surprised because the city council that was coming up for election at the time the police review board was being created, that was this what was considered, you know, lefty group who, ironically enough, I'm still trying to understand it, those same people are on the city council again now. I don't know why a city of 60,000 people, we have the same people serving over and over on our city council.
It's because that likely candidate, John Malkin, won't run because he's an anarchist. Steve tried. I mean, there's no support for communists, but there's a lot of anarchists in town. I think you could win, John.
You think I could?
I really do.
All right.
I think that's pretty unfair to say I didn't have support.
I actually
got a lot of support and did it like on pennies spent. Yeah. Whereas the people I was running against represent local money and the local status quo and the capitalist class itself, and so had the backing of corporate newspapers like the Sentinel, and outspent me $3 to my $3 per vote, where I spend about 3 cents per vote.
Would you run, John?
No, I've considered it a couple times. People have asked me about it, and I think generally I did my experiment in trying to work within the government structures to change them, and I came out of that with... That was my experience with the police review board, and I came out of that with the best thing that we can do at this point is have less contact with the police. Mm-hmm. That was my main feeling, and my idea around that was, well, what do we do then? Well, it's deal with our difficulties without contacting them as best as we can.
What about a cop watch program?
Problem is when the cops contact us. So.
That's right. Yeah, that brings up a cop watch. Well, if they're on film, I noticed at Peace Camp they behave way different than when they're not on film.
Oh yeah, and for 20 years I've made a practice of stopping when I see the police, and I do cop watch almost every time I see a cop encountering someone. I encourage people to do that, and if you don't feel comfortable doing that, go to a Know Your Rights workshop, or contact me or someone that you know that does feel comfortable doing that, and do it. My perception is police officers often interact quite differently with people when there's someone there observing. Mm-hmm. I'm also all for obstructing injustice when it's happening too. And
you mean
so,
like punching a cop in the face like Steve did?
Yeah, I know. I actually I've never heard from Steve directly about what happened and his feelings and his experience there, so I don't want to comment about that. And he might say something about
it. We talked about it a little earlier.
Oh, okay.
Would you do it again, Steve?
Oh yeah, I did the right thing. And and that cop was brutalizing that woman and terrorizing the child. And I stopped him. He was committing a crime, a violent crime against the woman and kid, and also a crime by violating our free speech rights by intervening against our anti-war protest. I have no problem with what I did. Actually, the police review board, that's one of the few cases, the only case I know of where they actually ruled in favor of the people on anything or against the police on anything, where they found that Officer Lefevre had used excessive force, endangered child, amongst other things, also using excessive force against me.
John, would you punch a cop if he was, you know, messing with your wife and kid or something in a similar situation?
I would really need to know the details of that situation. I don't punch people generally, and I would try to do everything possible before I did something like that. And I'd have to really know the particulars about it to say that. I very much think that protective use of force, and I really like that phrase, protective mm-hmm. use of force, is really valuable and important. And sometimes people think that nonviolence means non-action and letting things that are happening that are terrible, letting them happen. That's not what any valuable nonviolence teacher has ever said, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and 500 other people. They have said protective use of force is really important. That means when something violent is happening, it's not nonviolence to watch it happening. That's cowardice. Mm-hmm. Actually, to intervene with the intention of protecting someone, which is what Steve is describing, mm-hmm. is really valuable. Intervening to punish someone is what our structures of so-called justice are built on in this country. Punishment rather than protection. So you grab someone and then you say, you did this bad thing, and we will determine how much suffering you should now be forced to endure. 2 days in jail or 20 years in prison, even death in some cases. Mm-hmm. And police mete out that punishment by their own determination all the time on the way mm-hmm. to the justice structure too. They're going to speak to you in particular ways, touch you in particular ways, hurt you, threaten to hurt you as a means of punishment. That's nothing to do with protection or protective use of force.
Do you know any good cops on the force, either of you?
I think the nature of the job is such that no, because their job there is to protect this unjust system, and there might be some better ones for a while. I think they get corrupted by being there, seeing the kind of violence and other things that go on, and either they're going to be silent about it or go along with it and do it, mm-hmm. You know, or go along with it by being silent about it, or they're going to leave the police force. So I don't think any good cop would stay on the force. Any good person would stay on the force.
Do you agree with that, John?
Mm.
Do you know of a good,
okay,
good cop?
To be honest, I don't have that much connection with police officers in Santa Cruz or the police department now at all. I don't even know very many of them by name anymore. When 15 years ago, I knew a lot of them by name and even met with and spoke with a lot of them regularly. Now I just don't. What comes up, one comment I can make that's coming up for me is, I saw an article maybe a few months ago about Butch Baker's son becoming a police officer.
Yeah, I saw that too.
So what struck me about that article was the choice by the writer of that article and the editor not to include what would seem to me would be really, would come up right away if I was writing an article about Butch Baker. This article focused on, oh, you know, they're a family of police officers now, and he's, the son is now coming in, and oh, mm-hmm. it's kind of a great thing. Butch Baker had...
He's a molester.
Yeah, 15 years ago, eventually like 11 complaints against him by women in Santa Cruz of him touching them in sexual ways, and that wasn't mentioned in the article at all. And it really was an important part of creating the police review board and how the process of complaints worked or didn't work and all that.
I made jokes about the son continuing on in his father's legacy. But, you know, I actually heard from a homeless woman just the other day. I asked her who was some good cops, and she said the son of Baker's one of them, and I think she said Seeley, too. And I was thinking, same thing, Steve. Okay, well, he's brand new. It's in a few more years, we'll see. Whereas Winston and Warren, were, she said, were horrible.
Mm. My idea, too, from cops that I did talk to at that time 15 years ago was a lot of them thought, I want to help the world, and I want to help people. I'm going to become a police officer to do it. There, for some of them, there was that intention. The structure to do that is just not there mm-hmm. in policing. I mean, that my main focus in the whole time there was like, let's get training for police officers that's different than what they're now trained. They're now trained to either threaten violence or use violence when they arrive at a scene. Mm-hmm. That's predominantly what they do.
Yeah.
That doesn't work for us.
Yeah. Well, if you speak up at all, especially like an activist, they immediately jump up the level. You know, I think that's because how they deal with, say, a drunk or something. You know, if you show any weakness, the drunk is going to get out of control, so they just jump on him. But
I think they're also purposely sent out against activists. That's part of their job.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's part of the mistake. I think it's a mistake on many different levels, looking at what this government does and trying to give them advice on how to do it better, because it's just not our government, mm-hmm. and they're going to do it the way they do it. They have police to keep us down, mm-hmm. and
yeah.
that's how they're going to interact with us, because
yeah.
because violence and force and fear is a big part of how the system rules.
Yeah.
You know, right now they also have people duped a lot too. That's a big part of how they rule.
Mm-hmm.
But more and more they're gonna need even more and more violence and force. So I don't think they're gonna go in a more peaceful direction. I think they're going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, yeah. I hear what you're saying. Like this idea that if we handle our own difficulties ourselves, there's still a huge component, even dominant component of policing that has to do with disrupting. Actually, I mean, I think of it as disrupting democracy. Wherever democracy starts happening in the United States or around the world, U.S. police or U.S.
Yep.
government intervenes to stop it.
Yeah.
So
any real democracy,
we make
that
more money off fascism,
benefits the majority anyway.
I agree. I mean, it was totally confounding to me when I was a teenager and I started reading and understanding that the FBI, like TV shows and movies show the FBI mm-hmm. solving crimes. Like the FBI has predominantly disrupted internal democratic movements in the United mm-hmm. States. That's
yeah.
what they've done mostly. Including assassinating people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, that's the trouble with secret police.
Yeah.
And that gets me back to secret meetings. I tried to attend the Sub Rosa meeting, knowing I wouldn't be able to. They have a secret meeting. I brought up, you know, I mean, to me, that's where things go downhill. If there's public disclosure, people behave just like with the photograph of the police when they're interacting. They behave differently when they're under scrutiny, but when they're not.
Are you trying to join the Sub Rosa Collective or something?
Not necessarily. I just want to observe uh-huh. anarchism in action, and they're pretty. I think they're one of the better achieving anarchists. You know, they do a good job. I think that's the most radical of the the most political, the Sub Rosa, because you can go, you know, they allow activists, you know, to have groups there, and you don't get charged like everywhere else in town just to sit down.
Yeah, it's a nice space they have there. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about that secrecy, though? Even the name Sub Rosa means keep it secret.
I think that, you know, I talked to Wes about that. I think it was meant as a hysterical joke. Like this is so opposite of what we want to be. You know, a hiddenness that mm-hmm. we're going to call ourselves this hidden thing.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I think it doesn't work for some people. That some people don't get it, that joke.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of weird. What the hell?
I didn't know what the word meant.
They are very secretive, you know. I was asking, when does Madrone work? And the guy said, I don't want to tell you that, you know. Because he knows a lot of the history of anarchism in it.
No, I did some interviews at KZSC and other stations, and people said, hey, what does Sub Rosa mean anyway? And I made it my own little story because I didn't know that word or what it meant. I thought it must either refer to Rosa Luxemburg, Sub Rosa somehow, or Sub Comandante Rosa. I made up a story that it meant Sub Comandante Rosa. So if anyone wants to go that way with me, that's how I look at it.
Yeah, I think it goes back to like Egyptian god or something. Had a finger to their face. They got mistranslated. It meant be quiet, and then Rose was associated with the guy. You know, it just over history, it just developed that meaning. But what do you feel about, you know, open meetings instead of secret meetings? Transparency in all forms of politics.
I don't see it as a general rule, as a needing to be one or the other. I think it depends a lot on particulars.
Well, I think for policy, it should be. I mean, if they're out, you know, planning a crime, of course they should keep it quiet. You know, I don't expect the guys that broke the windows downtown to have an open meeting. But if you know, if it's a policy, it's just because power corrupts. You know, as you when it's secret, you can do. Things will happen. Like for instance, John, why did you do a stand aside on the vote for? Lower discount for the poor and the disabled to attend our meetings.
Wait, say that again?
Do you remember? I propose that we should give them one-third off just like a regular person at Free Radio. I was surprised.
I don't even remember why I did that. I don't even remember.
Okay. Well, it might have been I was giving you a hard time, but I... You know, everybody modified the proposal, and that's what they do in those consensus meetings. And it's the first one I'd been to, and I go, what the hell? They're attacking it, you know? And then someone said, well, we got three stand-asides. If I do three stand-asides, does that kill it? And I'm thinking, well, I'm getting demurred out here before we even get to the merits. What the hell?
But I don't know. I think that, you know, if people have less money, they should pay less. If people have no money and they want to have a radio show, they can still have a radio show. If people need special... if people need help getting there or whatever, we used to have someone who was blind, and occasionally I went in to help. I don't know. I'm up for anyone in our community having a radio show.
Well, I'm sort of blind. I've got the most dead air, I think, on this. Because I can't find a cursor for YouTube.
Oh, no.
But this show's great. I don't have to do that.
Ah, perfect. Hey, I'm going to get going very soon, and I just want to thank both of you. I've enjoyed the conversation. Mm-hmm. It's felt really alive and open, and I appreciate that.
Well, as I told you, John, of the shows I did, I like political ideologies, and both of you were very strong on that, and so it was very entertaining. I do think we need a think tank in this town or something to get things going.
That sounds totally exciting to me, yeah.
We'll make it a secret meeting, of course.
Oh, no.
Invitation only.
Yeah, thank you too, John. Yeah, this has been a very good conversation.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Yeah, let's do it again. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, good night. Bye.
Yeah, that was great. Because I do like political ideas. I mean, when I had the one with you, I go, that's great. Then John, he's a Buddhist. He's got two ideologies, anarchy and Buddhism. And I like to look for hypocrisy in ideologies, because ideology isn't—it's just a map for dealing with the world. None of them have completely all the answers.
Well, we strive to hopefully to have the answers. I mean, and I think if you want to bring up his Buddhism, you could bring up my atheism too. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, some people say Buddhism is atheism, but my atheism is one that enshrines no supernatural ideas like reincarnation or anything like that.
It doesn't require belief in a god to be effective, Buddhism.
Right.
So that's why it's called the... But it doesn't say there is no god either, because that's actually a belief, you know, because you can't prove there's no god.
Well, you can't prove that there's no tea kettle in orbit around Mars either, but there's no reason to think there is. There's no reason to think there is a god.
I have a quantum belief. I believe a certain percentage this, that, and the other thing.
Part god, part... part what?
I essentially believe God, but my version of God is not something most theists would recognize.
Right. Yeah, people have different beliefs. I think, to me, as like being part of a minority with atheism, that's actually faces some discrimination in the society. And other things.
You're a godless communist,
right? I think, and a scientist, and that's part of where my atheism comes from. I think it's good to stand up for me to stand up for my atheism too, because
proclaim it, say hallelujah for the lack of God.
Yeah, and you get a different reaction. You know, you get people saying there is a God. A lot of people are like, oh, yeah, whatever, you know. Say there is no God, and all of a sudden you have people, why are you being so hostile? I'm not being hostile, I'm just saying what I think.
What did God do to you that you would say that about her? Well, the thing is, though, at 101.1, there's a Jesus station down in Monterey. So as you drive down 41st and Capitola, you can hear Jesus on the street. And you hit the cross streets, you'll hit free radio. So sometimes I will put on twisted Jesus stuff. In fact, I had, like, you've seen Zeitgeist? And Jesus is just like an astrological myth. I put that on, and DJ Follow Me Sis calls up and goes, "Free, check to see if the antenna's working. All I'm hearing is Jesus stuff." I go, "No, that's me." I don't think we're going to convert any of the Christians to anarchism or communism, though. And that's the thing about ideologies. People tend to cling to it really tight. And that's what I mean. There's the hypocrisy grows in order to cling on to that belief and have it be the all, you know, answering.
There's people who have a lot of different beliefs and a lot of different contradictions in their beliefs, in my opinion, you know. And I've met communists that are Christians, there's going to be a lot of people who believe in revolutionary socialist ideas or various other ideas, and who are going to believe, and they're going to have their bring their religions along or not, you know.
Well, the Republican Party has used the Christians to form a majority to help them win elections. So that's how I like to peel off, because actually Christ was a revolution. I mean, why did he throw the money changers out of the temple? To me, that's such an obvious political act.
Right.
It has nothing to do with religion. I mean, he it wasn't the Sabbath. He healed on the Sabbath and said, you know, you're made for the Sabbath, not the Sabbath. Not, you know, the Sabbath's made for you, not you for the Sabbath. So, but it was Roman, but you had to trade Roman money for Jewish money to do the Sabbath. So you had Roman money. It was nationalism, basically, my view. And, you know, he was a threat to Rome. That's why they killed him. It wasn't because the Jews said, kill this guy for us, please. We can't do it ourselves. You know, they were killing people. Anytime the Sicarii were stabbing people as they walked by. You know, I do believe Christ was a revolution. And then when I read the Bible from an anarchist, I did it as a joke. I did a skit on it. It's on the archives at freakradio.org. I noticed if you looked at it from an anarchist point of view, you know, there's no marriage in heaven. Marriage is a government institution. Anarchist, but Jesus is going to, you know, smite all the nations with a sword from his mouth. He's coming back as an anarchist. The New Jerusalem is a do-it-yourself. You know, God's not going to... You're going to build your own house, grow your own food. Not build a house for somebody else and grow food for somebody else. It's a, you know, a worker's revolt.
Well, there's a lot of weird things. You read the Bible of, you know, destroying whole nations of, you know the kind of nationality or nationalism and, you know, some really brutal things.
There's a lot of lies in the Bible.
And a lot of backward stuff and, you know.
Not a word against slavery in the Bible.
Yeah, so, you know, it's... I don't know. To me, it's not the Bible itself is, and whether or not there even was a Jesus has been more and more in question too.
Oh no! I because of that money changes, I always thought there was, and now there's actual proof. The lost tomb of Jesus.
That tomb actually has been debunked. It's not.
Show me the debunking. There was a tomb that was found.
I saw a documentary. I believe it was on Science Channel or National Geographic. Some people went in. They looked at it. They weren't able to verify that that was Jesus's tomb in any way. I don't remember all the specifics. Well, they may have even found it not to have been. Actually, I don't remember now.
The science looked pretty good. I mean, they found 10 ossuaries and they moved them to a museum. The thing is that the names involved, there were common names. You know, Jesus, son of Joseph, is like one out of 1,000, or one out of 190. But when you put them all together, the combinations mean, yeah.
I don't.
Tomb.
I don't remember all the specifics now. Actually,
but he was married.
I opened my mouth and then I realized. Oh yeah, gotcha. I don't remember.
You're using
all
that
of it.
Circular reasoning again. Let's get Robert Norris in here to straighten you out.
Yeah, I don't remember all the specifics, but yeah.
I mean, he was married and he had a kid.
To me, it doesn't really matter.
True, you know, but that's not what they teach in the Bible, and the Christians don't want to admit that that tomb is the real tomb. Because it flies against their ideology.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just not that familiar.
Well, you're an atheist. Why the hell would you be?
Right. But, you know, I mean, some of it's interesting. You know, you read the story of creation, and it's like, well, there's no way, you know, if you know geology, you know evolution, you know all this is absurd. You read the story of Noah's Ark. Well, it's completely absurd. I mean,
It's mythologized, but there was a flood in 5500 BC. The Black Sea formerly was freshwater, and now it's saltwater, probably from glacier melt. What we're going to experience here very shortly, within a decade or some.
Yeah, but nothing like what is described in that story ever happened.
You know, Buddha popped out of a lotus. Paul Bunyan in it.
Oh, I mean, but for many years that was believed literally, and you know, things that can be explained by geology and evolution, like shells at the top of mountains for a long time. They were trying to explain it with the flood and, you know, Noah's flood and things like this that, you know, of course have been, there's no way. I mean, the amount of water on Earth isn't going to change, hasn't changed in any significant way. So you're not going to flood everything, but you're not going to have a pair of every species on a boat either.
You know? No room for the dinosaurs.
And then eating each other too, I suppose. But millions of species that have been described now, it's like, whoa. Yeah, I mean, and the absurdities of, like, you know, and poor Galileo figuring out that Earth went around the sun and being forced to, under threat of death, to renounce that.
Yeah, well, I'm more into the Eastern ones like John. You know, I mean, yoga is good for your health. Actually, yoga doesn't require a god either.
Yoga?
Yeah,
yoga is not really a religion.
No, it's not. But there's meditation
form of
involved.
Exercise and stretching. Really.
And then, well, there's Raj Yoga is different levels, breathing exercises.
Yeah. Okay.
And there are some metaphysics involved, too. You said you were a scientist. What do you mean by that?
Well, I've studied science, and I think science is the best way to ascertain the truth. Mm-hmm. Science isn't a collection of facts.
You test the truth.
It's the way to ascertain the truth. Mm-hmm. Test it when you can.
Mm-hmm. Form a hypothesis, see if your hypothesis comes true.
And accumulate evidence. Mm-hmm.
Classify. Yeah, I agree. I use science for religion, too.
Use science for religion?
Mm-hmm. Like I said, you know, if a better fact comes along, I'll believe that. I'm ready to switch my belief in a minute.
Right,
Because I only have a certain percentage on any certain thing. So you don't do physics or anything? Or?
I've done some physics. I wouldn't say I'm...
Quantum physics?
I've studied some quantum physics.
In quantum physics, you're getting real close to metaphysics.
Action at a distance. Not really. There's some people want to say that, but I don't agree. I think that,
telepathy? Do you believe in telepathy?
No. I don't think there's any evidence of telepathy at all.
I think there's very good evidence.
Like what?
That they've done tons of tests on it. And it follows from quantum physics.
Tons of tests? What tests?
You've heard of quantum tunneling?
First, let's finish this question of
telepathy. All right, you got. Well, I can't give you an exact. Well, Ryan did a bunch.
There was one test I saw something about where, excuse me, supposedly this parrot was reading the mind of its owner in the next room, and I was kind of impressed by the data this guy was putting out. I was like, "Holy shit, what's going on with this?" And but then other scientists looked at that the raw data and saw that the whole thing was just manipulated, and actually there wasn't any statistical evidence at all of any telepathy. But the way he presented it, it looked like he had found evidence of telepathy. And when I saw that, I was like, wow. And I was willing to consider it at that point. And then other scientists had debunked it.
Well, that's the trouble with science, that once again, you have an ideology. There's a certain paradigm that they need to defend.
Well, the ideology here is that we're trying to ascertain the truth. And and the best way of ascertaining the truth in that case is looking at the statistics. And the statistics were manipulated by one person.
Well, and on its face, it sounds crazy. Or the talking horse.
Right. It did. But that's how open I am, though, in terms of, show me the data. If the data says something, okay, let's look at this,
I think there's some very good data on reincarnation. Young children that can remember their past life up until like the age of 4. I couldn't give you the exact guy's name. I saw a show and it looked pretty good.
Yeah, see now. But something like that is like, how do you even test that? And to begin with, there's the same problem there was with the telepathy there of like, well, how does that work? How does that happen? How does, and it's
quantum
like...
Quantum tunneling.
Well, what's that?
Well, that's the idea that, it can cross an impossible barrier.
But what's it?
The existence of the particles don't actually simply exist. They just partially exist, depending... sometimes it's over here, maybe it's over here,
But we're talking there about very small particles, like electrons that are moving around.
Right.
But we're made up of a whole lot of these and a whole lot of neutrons and protons. And once these things come together on a macro scale, there's certain ways they do function. And there's certain ways that our minds function on that scale, and that's a macro scale. For that macro scale to jump through tunnels, quantum tunnels, or whatever you're talking about, it's a stretch beyond my imagination, or I think probably beyond reality.
Well, that's your ideology. That's your paradigm. You're wedded to it.
Well, show me the evidence. That's the whole thing.
Well, what's consciousness?
What is consciousness? Mm-hmm. That's consciousness is what goes on in the cerebral cortex of our brain.
But what is it? What is it made of? How does it happen?
It's made up of a lot of different interacting things, but within brain cells within the brain.
Where's the evidence for consciousness?
The fact that we're sitting here talking on these microphones is one piece of evidence.
The only evidence is that you're conscious.
That's not... but that's pretty goddamn good evidence. I mean,
you can't pinpoint it anymore.
What's the evidence of Earth? Well, the fact that it's right here, that we're on it.
But how do you know I'm conscious? I mean, you see me move around and stuff, but how do you know I'm not just programmed to do that?
Well,
you don't really have evidence. There is no, you don't really have evidence. Well, you have evidence of electrical
activity. Well, there is evidence because we can look at.
Why isn't a machine conscious? It has electrical activity as well.
It's not
like a computer.
It's not the same, though. I mean, but it's interesting. There's artificial intelligence that's being developed. That's pretty fascinating at this point. I don't think it's. No, conscious, so. No. But
anyways, there's been some recent research that it's actually there's microtubules in the brain, and other animals have them too, even paramecium and stuff, that form resonant chambers. So it's a wave function. It isn't your neurons or your glial cells; those are just a wiring. It's actually like light or a laser, really. It's coherent brain waves, and the more coherent they are, the more conscious you are. The more time seems to slow down. You could look up, I think his name is Hameroff, or you could. He was an Arizona anesthesiologist. He calls it Bing. He calls it the Bing factor. He says even an electron is conscious, but only once every 10 million years. You need the complexity of the human brain to be conscious continuously.
I mean, the whole idea that an electron can be conscious is just nonsense, in my opinion.
How about a paramecium? Do you think a paramecium can be conscious? How do they find the
mates? I don't think so, because they don't have a cerebral cortex.
They have no nerves. All they have are those microtubules.
They're just one cell.
How do they find their mates and eat and stuff like that?
Well, how do our cells do various things, like macrophages that go around and defend our body from attack? There are things that cells can do that aren't.
He would
aren't
say
conscious.
They're all conscious to some extent. He's got a theory with Roger Penrose that the brain is a quantum computer, and that explains telepathy because it's a non-local phenomenon. But this is science. You could look it up. I think it's one of the biggest discoveries in the last century.
Telepathy, though, would be easy to prove beyond all this that kind of speculation. If there was telepathy, you could prove it. You could do experiments like this guy was doing with his parrot and this woman, and you know, one's looking at a picture, the other, should be able to say what it is, or you know, if telepathy can actually be done. But there hasn't been that. I mean,
I believe there has. I mean, it's statistical, so it's hard to.
Well, statistics are. I mean,
I know exactly what you're saying.
If.
But anyways, we're losing listeners here as we get off the politics. When are we going to get that union started here? And
a union started.
That was another thing.
There already are some unions.
Yeah, I was going to say that anarchism and communism started during the Industrial Revolution, basically, because the capitalists were oppressing people with bad working conditions, and the unions are a way of fighting back. Mm. But unions went mainstream.
Well, unions have been mainstream
for a long time.
But the thing, part of what's gone on when unions have actually moved things forward, moved conditions of the working class forward, moved politics forward in this country, was when radicals. Within the working class started leading strikes and things like that and took on or else did it without the control of the union the main union leaders, national mm-hmm. union leaders and stuff like that. It's like the Teamsters at the time of the 1934 Teamsters strike. The national leadership, they could care less about most anything about the working class, the conditions mm-hmm. of the working class.
Just their union is all they care about.
The Trotskyists who fought their way into the union and organized the truck drivers in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. They were able to transform the union through really organizing that fight. And taking over a big part of the what was going on. But if it was left up to the main union leaders, who are at that
corrupt.
Time, who are just like the main union leaders we have today, mm-hmm. nothing would have happened.
Self-serving
and supporting the supposed friends of labor in the government, you know. Mm-hmm. And you have the same thing going on today. I mean, why has there been no general strike in Wisconsin when so many people have called for one? Mm-hmm. It's because the union bureaucrats have a different strategy. They say, well, no, let's call in the Democrats and let's elect Democrats. And, you know, meanwhile, the Democrats were saying, yeah, we want to cut your wages 12% here in Wisconsin. We just don't want to get rid of the union.
You know, keep your collective bargaining and take less money.
And here they are inviting all these Democrats to speak at their rallies and teaching, working the best they can to teach the workers to depend on those Democrats rather than the action, their own actions, which general strike would have been very powerful and would have won back a whole lot of what the government was trying to take away.
What
happened to it in Wisconsin?
Just anywhere. When the
communists were leading the unions in the United States in the 1930s and 40s,
and the anarchists were involved there too.
Yeah, but who was leading? Like who led the Teamsters strike? It was the Trotskyists in Minneapolis, uh-huh. and then the general strike in Minneapolis. Who led the longshoremen in San Francisco in 1934? It was the Communist Party. Who led the Toledo Autolite strike that year too? It was the Workers' Party, mm-hmm. and it was actually the organized socialists, communists that were making a difference in leading the working class and fighting back and making some changes, and that a lot of that takes taking on the leadership that's already there in the unions, taking them on in a very straightforward way when.
Is
when
that
necessary.
Happening at all anymore?
Yeah, I mean, but we're a lot smaller in terms of.
Are you infiltrating any unions now?
Me specifically?
Yeah.
No, I'm a student right now at UCSD. But
You tabled downtown,
right? I've been a part of different unions. I don't feel too comfortable going to people outside of a workplace at this point and saying you should organize a union unless they want to do it.
Well, the thing is, people in Santa Cruz are so desperate to get any kind of job so they can stay
right.
here. They're not going to join a union for
right.
losing their job.
So that's another thing is you know trying to focus on what's productive. I think the biggest thing that's needed right now, if I'm going to make a big difference is I think we're looking at a situation where the socialist parties of this country are pretty bad. Most of them have watered down their programs so much that they're not really
they're posers.
I don't know if they're posers, but I don't think they really believe in a fight for power either. I think they're more about
money benefits.
I think the socialist movement is so small in this country that it's people who really believe in it that are part of it. But they're more about organizing things like organizing protests to try to put the fire on the feet of the politicians to get what they want and stuff like that. Rather than being more honest to people and say, well, you're not going to get what you want from these people. And we really, it's a much bigger fight than that.
I try and tell Robert. I mean, don't even bother with city council. You know, they have very little power, I don't think. And
right.
They're changing all the time, but things don't change here. It just gets worse and worse. It's staff. They're year after, like the police, year after year after year after year, entrenched.
Yeah. Well, one thing I like I like a number of things that Robert does. I do have some of those disagreements with Robert too, though. Mm-hmm. One thing about it is he does hold them responsible too by mm-hmm. doing what he does, and I think that's a very good thing. He doesn't let them off the hook. They pretend to be so progressive and so so good, and he exposes the truth about a lot of what they're up to.
Well, he's the only one really working on the class war every day.
Yeah.
Oh, he's got the time. He's got that trust or whatever. But he does keep pushing it. I disagree with his tactics sometimes.
Yeah. His eyes would roll if I told him, well, what we need to do is organize a revolutionary party. Yeah.
How's that coming along? We talked earlier about how, like, there's maybe a dozen communists in town, but there's hundreds of anarchists.
Right. I haven't put the kind of effort into it that I should, for various reasons.
Well, you're going to need the anarchists.
We're all going to need each other in some ways, there is a struggle of ideas too, and
there's fewer radicals in town anyway. It's gentrified. It's expensive to live.
Right,
here.
Right.
So that I don't see anybody really doing much on the class war in this town because it's a bourgeois town, I guess.
It's also there's a lot of working class here.
Like there used to be.
And
it's
poor
tough.
People, too.
It's tough.
It's tough, yeah.
Section 8 or something.
But it's still here. And we're not that far from big working class areas, too, like Watsonville and San Jose and so forth. But one of the things I'm working on right now is an article on the situation in Libya opposing the war that the U.S. is waging there, and part of what I'm putting forward in that article is the need for a revolutionary party that gets rid of imperialism once and for all, that works in that direction, and I'm going to be
free radio. Talk about martial law, but I got to get.
Oh, I didn't
hear him.
I didn't hear what was said.
Could you address the issue of martial law?
Martial law. I don't think they're about to declare martial law here, and
not for a few years. But I am expecting.
You're expecting it
just from the astrology.
I mean, they don't declare martial law until they lose control of us. Which could happen anytime, but the most immediate thing is let's get organized right now. Use the fact that we do have the ability to
get organized
to openly say I think
just locally.
Well, there's a number of different levels of being organized.
To me, it means recruiting. We don't have a mass movement. And
exactly.
That's like I was talking with the anarchists. They're so standoffish. They're never going to have a mass movement. They're never going to have a revolution. They have the numbers to be politically effective in this town, but they're off in their own little thing. You know, clubs or meetings.
Yeah, I can't really.
Well, you can't speak to that.
Speak to. To what they're doing.
It's more popular than communism. When I was younger, it was all commies, you know, very few anarchists.
Yeah, and there's reasons for their popularity. I mean, it takes an understanding of what went wrong with Stalinism and you know, building a socialist movement that also integrates in a knowledge of opposing Stalinism and not making those types of mistakes.
You know, that could be why communism is less, because a lot of the unions and the socialism has all been integrated into the mainstream.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. And, you know, and we had the McCarthy era that drove all the communists out of the leadership of the unions. That's part of why our unions are so bad in this country now, too. Yeah. But also there's a certain conservatization that goes on in unions, all through the 50s and 60s, part of the 70s, maybe even, but definitely the 50s and 60s. If those union bureaucrats who really didn't believe in fighting, and with all the communists taken away, if they asked for a pay raise during those times, they'd just get it automatically. They didn't have to put up a fight. Workers didn't have to put up a fight. So, you know, what a lot of socialists were saying about, you know, fighting back and how unionism was done in the 40s and 30s
didn't
mean much to people. Yeah. And the union leaders didn't have to be people who really put up a fight in order to be getting things for the workers and seeming okay.
Because after World War II, we were economically booming because the rest of the world was in tatters and we were exporting everywhere. So, yeah, it was really easy for everybody to just move up automatically.
Right. And now that we need to move back to the, a lot of those tactics.
We do need unions now because wages are getting cut, price of land's going up.
But there's been a lag, a learning curve that has been pretty bad.
That's the other thing. It's a generational thing. You forget people have a 10-year horizon. They don't remember the tactics. Like I went to an anarchist lecture where they were talking about, you know, doing a bunch of time because they wouldn't cooperate with a grand jury. And I remember, you know, Eldridge Cleaver just didn't remember anything in front of a grand jury. And same thing with Bush's attorney general. I don't remember. You can't be put in jail for not remembering.
No.
And you're not ratting anybody off either.
Right.
And if you smoke a lot of pot, you're not maybe committing perjury when you say you can't
maybe
remember.
Maybe even it's believable.
Okay, well, we got the next DJ coming in, a noted anarchist. He does a lot of volunteer work. You know, I don't do crap, really. So I got to start recording this and getting ready. But it's nice to have you.
All enjoyed right. Well, thank you for having me on here. And
I like getting the two of you and John together because you're both intellectually articulate and have your own ideologies, very similar. John was very clever not to fall into my hierarchy trap, or he was for a vanguard. He even said he, you know, believes in competence without completely committing to it.
Right. Yeah.
So he's a thinking man's anarchist, because anarchy is a very flexible belief, because there's so many different authors, whereas Marxism is kind of, you know, you follow Karl Marx. Am I wrong?
Well, I have disagreements with Marx. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's all not... Right. I think there is a lot of flexibility, but there's also an understanding of the need to act in a very purposeful way and be organized to do that.
And you believe
that
in democracy, too. I mean, not for a totalitarian communism.
Well, in workers' democracy.
Well, if everybody has an equal vote, since the oppressing class is so small,
right,
the workers are going to run things.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's what Rosa Luxemburg put forward is universal suffrage, which I think can be part of workers' democracy.
Direct
and should
democracy
be.
Goes across all. Democracy believes in it. Mm. You're a communist that believes in it.
But
John Malcolm believes in it.
Right.
Same thing with.
But the capitalists don't really believe in democracy.
Hell no.
Once it starts,
call them what they are, fascists. Believe in state.
Once it starts getting democratic,
capitalism.
They want to smash it.
They want the bank to be bailed out when they fail. They don't believe in just getting out there and winning or losing on their own. They want the government to back them up. They're not really capitalists. They're state sponsored capitalists.
Well, the capitalists have their state. And the state helps them out.
Hand in glove. It's the harlot of Babylon that rides the beast.
Yeah.
We're getting religious again. Okay, but thanks for being on.
All right, thank
it's
you.
A great show.
Thanks for having me on. All right, great.